Welcome into the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Well, folks, you know, some things are just worth the wait. And today is no exception. I know last week I had promised you Aaron Dees and from Small Town Monsters. And we had a little bit of a delay, and that's okay. Sometimes some things are just worth the wait. Today we are talking about hunting grounds, dogmen of the lakes. And I'm looking forward to the show, folks, because dogmen is one of those topics that you've told me as a listener absolutely scares the you-know-what out of you. And I know for a fact it kind of terrifies me as well. You know, when I was younger, I used to do a little bit of hunting. And out in the woods, I used to tell people, you know, I wouldn't see anything more than a bobcat. And I'm glad I didn't, because I read some of this stuff now as an older adult, and I just don't want to run into this stuff. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest before we bring him back on. Of course, he was with us with another book previously, but, you know, we want to bring him back and learn about this one. He was with us previously with the Texas Dogman Triangle, but, of course, we're talking about a whole different region this time. Aaron Dees is a San Antonio, Texas-based author and researcher and the former editor-in-chief of Paranormality magazine. When he's not chasing werewolves, he enjoys books, cartoons, video games, podcasting, and nunchucks. You got to love that combination, by the way. Aaron lives with his wife, Sarah, with whom he hosts the podcast Hey Strangeness. You got to check that out. We'll have a link in the description of this program. And his son, Ezra, along the way with too many cats near the Alamo. By the way, his son is adorable. You have to, you just have to take my word on that. The new book, by the way, is absolutely astounding. Got a chance to read it. The book is called Hunting Grounds, Dogmen of the Lakes. There's also a movie coming out based on a documentary with Shannon LeGros, Hunting Grounds, Dogmen of the Lakes. Let's bring him in now. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome back to Darkness Radio, Aaron Dees. Hi, sir. How are you?
I'm fantastic, Tim. How are you?
Excellent, my friend. Now that you are with us on this program, I've been looking forward to having you back and looking forward to talking about the land between the lakes.
Me too. Thank you. Very excited.
First of all, you got to have balls the size of grapefruits, my friend. That's all I got to say.
No, man. No, no, I don't do anything scary. I'm a writer.
Don't say that.
I did actually go to the land between the lakes at night and crawl down in some of these bunker things during the research phase of this book. That was kind of spooky. I won't lie there. But in general, I lead a very cushy life. So, you know, it's got to be honest.
I don't know. We're going to get into this here. And I think we might change some people's minds because I'll put it this way. There was no walk across shag carpet in order to try and find these things. I mean, there was some danger to what you were doing.
Potentially. Anytime you go into the woods, especially at night, and especially in an isolated place like the land between the lakes, where you don't really have cell reception most of the time, mm-hmm. there's some inherent risk there. You know, not just because we might meet a dog man, which I'm sure we'll get into here shortly, but wildlife, you know, tripping and falling, running into a tree branch, getting poked in the eye by a tree branch that you didn't see, like just all real things that can really ruin your day. So, you know, there's some risk there, but some people think werewolves live there also, and that's why I went.
So. Now we're going to split this up into categories because I know I just had Seth on the program, Seth Breedlove, a few weeks ago. And I know there's a little bit of not only a discrepancy, but maybe a little burr in the saddle about where the difference between werewolves, dogman, rougarou, and other creatures. And I know it might be a little bit of a sticking point. Can you tell me why, first of all?
Yes, I'm going to crack my knuckles here.
Yeah.
So this is actually something that's been a central point of a lot of the research I've done, because you kind of have two schools of thought on, well, no, you have many schools of thought on this topic, but there are kind of two main ways of thinking amongst people who are very interested in the dogman werewolf niche. And one is that dogmen and werewolves are two separate things, that the term werewolf applies to supernatural beings, very often things that are fictitious, that come from Hollywood. That's not something that's real. Dogman is a cryptozoological entity. People are often of the opinion in this camp that it's a real animal that's yet to be classified, and that those two concepts are separable. Then you flip to the other side of the coin, and you'll talk to a lot of researchers who feel that the cryptid dogman and the supernatural werewolf phenomena, that there is a relationship there, and that the dogman that a lot of witnesses report and talk about as being an animal is not actually an animal, but is something on another level, maybe from another dimension, maybe some kind of a spirit, maybe some kind of an alien. That depends who you talk to and what report you're looking at. But there is kind of a, there can be some contention there. For my purposes, me personally, I use those terms interchangeably. Okay. And there are other researchers that have spent a significant amount of time on this that will say that as well. I won't call anybody out because I didn't ask for their permission to do that. But sure. One, the root term of werewolf is wolf man or man wolf. Essentially dog man, essentially the same thing. Etymologically, as far as the language of history goes, I'm just not even going to attempt that word today.
Okay.
They mean the same thing. Sure. For the history of language goes. Gosh, I had that all mapped out in my head and I botched it.
No, that's fine.
If we trace werewolf to its roots, it means dog man, essentially. So given that, and then the other side of that as well is that when you're talking to witnesses and you're looking at eyewitness reports, and this to me is the most significant thing, that is the term they use to describe what they saw. And as researchers, as writers, as reporters, whatever role we cast ourselves in, it's not my place to say to anybody who's seen anything inexplicable, well, no, what you actually saw was this. I know you said it looked like a werewolf, but that's actually dog man. We've identified that that's a dog. We don't know what dog man is. Mm-hmm. And very often as you're looking into this stuff, I'm finding there's a pretty even split between these more supernatural, spooky encounters, and then some that seem to be more run-ins with just regular animals. And okay. So it becomes very difficult. But again, for me, I use those terms interchangeably. And I love the fact that for both the Dogman Triangle, Werewolves in the Lone Star State, and Dogman Territory, Werewolves in the Land Between the Lakes, Seth used both terms. He used both terms in the titles of both of those movies because that sparked so much debate and conjecture and commentary that it actually played into my research for, you know, the book I just finished. So it's been a very interesting thing to research and to observe. And that was a really long, rambling explanation. I apologize for that.
No, if anything, it clarifies. Because when you sit down and watch American Werewolves 2, I think the draw is to hear the word werewolves. And I think that gets the general public to sit down and watch it and go, ooh, werewolves, scary. You know, that gets everyone to sit down and go, I want to see a werewolf. Mm-hmm. But the thing that really, I think, absolutely scares your eyeballs out is to see that actual footage from Brenda Harris of that thing moving around in the dark and going, what mm-hmm. in the actual hell is that?
It's a very spooky film.
Yeah.
And it's available to stream now. And I actually, I made it a point to not incorporate any material from American Werewolves 2. And I actually held off on watching it until I had most of this book sketched out because I really wanted to not pull too much of that in, but then also see how my research in The Land Between the Lakes would line up with that. And some of the parallels are chilling and striking.
And you did a great job of separating yourself even further, because keep in mind, Seth is talking about skinwalkers as well. And skinwalkers is more of a Utah basin, I guess, Western phenomena.
Yeah,
right.
A lot of these terms, you mentioned Rougarou, the skinwalker earlier, a lot of these terms are very specific and can be traced to very specific cultures and tribes. Rougarou, we can trace to French and French Canadian settlers. And that, of course, comes from France, the loup-garou, you know, which again means wolfman. Mm-hmm. But we can trace those to specific places versus the dogman slash werewolf archetype that is present in so many cultures and places throughout history that it's almost an overbearing concept that seems to categorize in some ways, you know, a lot of these other phenomena. And I want to caveat that by saying that I don't mean to take any indigenous belief or, you know, cultural thing and say, yeah, it's a werewolf. I'm not in a position to do that. I don't have that authority, okay, or knowledge. I'm not that smart. But the visual archetype of an upright wolf appears over and over and over and over again in many, many different cultures. Yeah. So to me, that's what the werewolf is as a concept. But
sure. Now what's interesting, especially with Dogman, is you get this creature that you easily could mistake for Dogman, but has a totally different, I guess, behavior set. Wolfman, you assume to be something that would be singular, that, you know, that whole human changing into a wolf, baying at the moon, you know, you get the Hollywood archetype. Dogman seems to be something that's hunting in packs, that's very, I don't know, predatory? Is that a good way of putting it?
They do. In a lot of the witness accounts that we get, and this is especially prevalent in what I encountered while researching The Land Between the Lakes, they seem to behave in a manner that is consistent with the behaviors of known canines. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is there is a succession of anecdotes about them stalking or following people. There is visual evidence captured by Jesse and Joe Doyle of Hellbent Holler that seems to correlate that idea. It seems that the image that they captured, which you can see online and which is also featured in the book with their very generous permission, seems to illustrate or show, not illustrate, it's an actual thermal image, seems to show a creature looking out of the woods at them as they're passing by on this path. All things are subject to interpretation, but once you've looked at this image and you look at the area in which they captured it, and I actually had the opportunity to visit the location where they captured it, it's hard to imagine anything was going on other than a large animal observing them from very close to the trail in the dark. That's just what I believe happened, factually. I'm not going to sit here and tell you it was a dog man because I can't prove that, but, you know. That's what we were there to research. So
well, in the book, if you don't mind me saying, I'll give them this much of this. You're out there in the middle of summer and you're using a FLIR camera.
Yes.
And it's hotter than hell out there. Let's just face it. Mm-hmm. And with a FLIR camera, and if it's hotter than hell, you're really not going to get much of anything. Right. Mm-hmm. But this thing is the body temperature itself is just cooking.
It is as black against the background in that image as the outline of my shirt is against this purple light that's behind me. And yeah, this, the way, based on my very rudimentary understanding of thermal technology, there are different settings and different thermal spectrums you can look at. But the one that Jesse and Joe had it set to was black hot, meaning that heat signatures would appear black on the camera. Mm-hmm. And most of what was around them was like a paler gray or whitish color with some hints of black just where there was nothing for it to pick up. But then you just have this black form right in the middle, dead center, which is very distinctly a head and two pointed ears. You know, we can spend all day trying to figure out what animal that might be, but this is an area where we receive repeated encounters of eyewitnesses encountering upright walking canines fitting that description. And now we have this image that was captured in the same area. That's not speculation or conjecture. That is fact. Now, what that image is, if it is proof of anything, that is where we get into speculation and conjecture. But it's needless to say, I was very excited when all this started to develop a couple years ago. Jesse and Joe were putting this information out there. I was like, my God, I have to write a book about this.
Yeah, I was going to say, is there a slight bit of soiling of the pants, too, when you find that out?
It's I have these moments when I'm researching this stuff, and it's happened the most with me with dogman research, you know, because I've spent the most time on that. But where, and I'm sure anybody who's spent a long time in this world, you know, you've seen this, you've felt this, but you just have these moments where you're like, my God, this is why I'm researching this stuff.
Yeah.
This is why I'm interested in this stuff, is because when you find something that seems so inexplicable and you get even the tiniest hint that it has a connection to reality, it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming for me personally.
Well, and then there's that moment too, and I'm sure you know this, Aaron, where, you know, you spent plenty of time out in the woods and you have this bubble of security, right? When you go out there and you think, oh, you know, you think of yourself as an autonomous creature. You're out there, you have this false sense of security, you wander out in the woods and you think everything's going to be all right. And then you see an image like that in a FLIR camera and you think, that thing could rip me the F apart.
Yeah, and it doesn't even have to be a paranormal entity. It can be a bear, it can be a wolf, it can be a cougar, depending on where you are.
Right.
You know, but the strangeness surrounding, at least in particular, that capture, that's hard to get over for me, man. That's tough.
Yeah.
That's tough.
And it just happened to be on that particular day, it chose to pass you up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. I feel sometimes I'm fortunate in that I haven't had any of these experiences myself. I've just been lucky enough to meet people who have, because I don't know what I would do. I don't know. My God, this
point. No idea. let's backtrack a little bit. Let's talk about the history of the Land Between the Lakes, what exactly it is, and how did you come across it, and why this area, and choosing to write about this area? What was it that attracted you?
Yeah, so I'll start with the first part of the question. The Land Between the Lakes is a national recreation area under the purview of the Parks and Recreation Service, I believe. or the National Forestry Service, or both.
Okay.
They're both involved. It was established in 1963 as a part of a bill that was signed by JFK, but was not enacted until after his death under the Johnson presidency. And essentially what they did is they dammed the two rivers on either side of what was not a peninsula at the time and flooded a vast region of this valley, creating the largest inland peninsula in the United States, and changing the name to the land between the lakes as opposed to the land between the rivers. That sounds great, mm-hmm. except a whole lot of people lived there.
Yeah.
The numbers as to how many, I've run into reports that say 600 families. I've run into some that say 900 families. I was able to find an interview on YouTube as a part of an old documentary that was shot in, I think, 2001, where they interviewed some elderly residents who had lived there at the time. And they said 2,000 families. There were 2,000 families there at that time. So
wow.
numbers are a little spotty, but thousands of people, you know, yeah. we can say were forcibly displaced. Eminent domain was invoked. The Tennessee Valley Authority was in charge at the time. And people who didn't leave, some of them were arrested. There are stories that homes were bulldozed while people were out, while they were in town picking up supplies. They came home and their homes had been bulldozed into a pit that had been dug behind the house. There are stories of houses being razed. How much accuracy there is in some of those individual anecdotes, it's difficult to say, but we know that a lot of this stuff happened. We know that people had their homes taken away, that many of them lost everything.
Wow.
And these were not recent occupants. These were the descendants of people that settled in the 16, 17, 1800s. You know, 16 is probably a little too early. 17, 1800s. They'd been there for generations.
Yeah.
Some of the original occupants or occupants of European descent of what would become the land between the lakes were led there by Daniel Boone, noted wow. American frontiersman. Who I happen to be distantly related to.
Really?
And that's in the book too. I ran into that while I was looking at this. I was like, oh man, great, great, great Uncle Boone was there. he's not my uncle. He's like a 50th cousin or something.
Wow.
So these people had been there for generations, and the government came in and said, we're turning this into a national park. Essentially, you got to get out of here. And then that happened. And time passed, and it did not become a hub of economic activity for Tennessee and Kentucky. It did not become the go-to destination for all things outdoors, and it fell into great disrepair and neglect. And when I visited it in 2023, what year is it? Last year?
Yep.
2023.
Yep.
It's very evident that the funding is not there. The attention to it is not there. And I don't mean to say this disrespectfully or to speak ill of it. It is a beautiful, wild, amazing place. And I would love to live close by so I could spend more time there. My only complaint is that while I was there, we had such a limited timetable because it is such a beautiful place.
Yeah.
But sadly, it has been left in a lot of places to decay. And that's changed. As of 2022, the American Heritage Something Act, I can't remember the whole name, allotted another $8 million in annual funding. As of 2023, according to Joe Doyle, the TVA only had 5 officers in the park total.
That's
I believe five. One supervisor, I believe, and 4 officers to oversee 170,000 acres. So hopefully some of that 8 million goes to getting some more people in there so this place can be better taken care of and be preserved in the way in which it should be preserved. Mm-hmm. It's an important piece of history.
Yeah.
The long and the short of it is that there was this big buildup. It was going to be this big recreation area. All these people were displaced, and now a lot of it is kind of just sitting there. So that is set against a backdrop or paralleled with this rash of recurring sightings of this upright canine creature. So a lot of the speculation is that the government knows that these things are out there, and that's why they're leaving it to kind of be as it is. I think there are some problems with that narrative, but, you know, that's just my opinion.
Right.
But that's sort of where we're at least with regards to the dogman stuff. But you also have UFO sightings. You have ghosts. You have 5 Sasquatch reports for every every dogman sighting I can name. I'm getting my monsters mixed up.
That's okay.
The LBL is also only about 30 miles from Kelly Hopkinsville, which is the site of the notorious Kelly Hopkinsville incident. And the Mantell UFO crash took place very, very close to the land between the lakes. So this is a hub for a lot of strange activity. Whether or not there's a connection between all of it, I couldn't tell you. But the fact is, all of this stuff is purported to be there.
You're not the first person to say that there's been a connection actually between UFO and Bigfoot or UFO Sasquatch. And you're not the first person to say that there's a connection between UFO Sasquatch and Dogman. Why is it that there's that nexus there? Is there such... Now, I hate to throw this in here because you stated earlier in the program that you believe that Dogman is more animal than magical or animal than supernatural, but I mean, do we change the thinking and say something to the effect of maybe it's thrown in that mix along with Alien and Sasquatch?
So I got to be careful here.
Sure.
Either way, somebody's going to disagree with me, and that's fine. I think there's precedent in the Dogman world for it being supernatural, and I also think there's precedent for a cryptozoological phenomena. I think there's more than one thing going on there. The problem with that is that how likely is it that there's one upright canine out there? Never mind two different kinds. And other researchers have said that. That's just a sentiment I really agree with. So I get stuck there. As far as a connection between UFO and Bigfoot, I am not convinced that there is a tangible link. I do see areas like the land between the lakes where we have documented UFO sightings, and then we have documented Sasquatch sightings. We might have some that take place on the same night. I think there could be a number of reasons for that. If we're to assume that aliens are extraterrestrial or interdimensional visitors and that they're visiting us for research purposes, which is a line of speculation I think a lot of people assume, they would naturally also want to study wildlife. If Bigfoot is a part of our natural ecosystem that we've just yet to classify, makes sense they would want to study it. If there aren't very many of them, there are only so many specimens for them to look at. Eventually, a human being is going to stumble across one at the same time. There are only two documented UFO reports that at least that are kind of big in the public eye where you have a Sasquatch like alien. And I'm sure someone's screaming at their speakers right now going, no, there's also this one and this one and this one. But the two that I'm aware of are the encounter that precipitated the Gateshead Gray incident, which took place in England in the 60s, wherein this young boy, I believe his name was Robert, stumbled upon a UFO in the woods. And there was an assemblage of alien beings, one of which he described as looking like Bigfoot. Then you also have the Chestnut Ridge area where you had these sightings of these ape-like looking alien creatures. But we could very easily just assume, and this is kind of the line of speculation that I go on, is that those beings were a specific being specific to that time and place, not necessarily indicative of the entire Sasquatch phenomenon. That is my opinion.
Right.
As far as why the land between the lakes, man, that's when it gets into some really weird stuff, because you have this history of displacement. A lot of people have died there over the years. A lot of crime has gone on there, you know, because it is so isolated and there are so few eyes on it. Bodies have been dumped there. The Civil War, of course, was very heavy in that area. Slavery was going on in that area. You had a history of iron mining that spanned about 70 some years of active iron mining there. So a lot of people died. You know, so then you kind of get into, okay, maybe all this stuff is supernatural, because we like to speculate that ghosts and hauntings are the result of negativity and death. So is that why all this stuff is happening? It is mind blowing and has kept me up for months. So I'm really glad this book is out there. It's somebody else's problem now.
Yeah. Is there, and I guess I would ask this as well too, Aaron, is there still mineable resources in this area as well?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure.
Okay.
I know today there's no way that would happen because they have done so much to remediate the damage that was done during the mining. There is a particular mineral there, which is the rocks in some areas are blue. They're this deep blue. And that has to do with shale runoff from iron refinement. It's actually illegal to even remove those rocks as a souvenir. They're protected because it's a part of the historical setup, you know.
Yeah.
I'm sure if they wanted to and they dug deep enough, they could find more resources. But they've done a lot of work to try to recover, including reintroducing native species that were wiped out by human occupants. You know, reef shaping, bringing in new plants and stuff like that. That was actually something I spent a lot of time researching that I only got to talk about for maybe two paragraphs, but it's just the massive amount of work that's been done to try to remediate a lot of this environmental damage before all this funding dried up, you know, sometime after the 60s.
Reason I ask is because, you know, we also, one of the reasons we think that maybe, you know, UFO may show up is that they're trying to mine resources as well. And if you try to connect UFO, Sasquatch, whatever, I know a Sasquatch aren't trying to mine resources, but the whole reason for UFO being there, but you know, Sasquatch and Dogmen have to have some sort of resources around in order to maintain a race or their kind. Listen to me sounding like I'm all racist against Sasquatch and Dogman. But in order to maintain their species, they have to have some sort of resources around, correct? I mean, other than feeding on humans, obviously.
That's kind of one of the reasons that we could argue that the Dogman can be looked at as a physical being. Why is it existing in an environment like the Land Between the Lakes? Food, water, concealment, temperature extremes throughout the season, sure, but we know wolves can survive from summer to winter. We know that. That's a fact. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense. Where it becomes difficult is when you speak with witnesses who talk about things like mind speak, who describe seeing a translucent, illuminated being moving in the underbrush and seeing a mist that gave them, you know, severe physical distress to where they needed almost medical attention afterward, to that level of illness just from encountering one of these creatures. Dogs don't do that.
Right.
They can smell pretty bad. You can't see through them. They can't leap up the side of a 20-foot cliff in two bounds. They can't do that. That is what some of these witnesses are describing. So again, that's when I get into maybe there's more than one thing going on, but yeah. I could chase myself around there all day.
No. It's very interesting indeed. Tell you what, let's take our break right here. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about what you found when you went out to the LBL. You went out there with Shannon LeGros, and it's interesting because once you got out there, you had your own resources, your own information sources when you went out there. We're going to talk about Martin Groves and that huge source of information for you and what exactly he had to say about the area. When we come back, we'll talk about what exactly you found when you got out there. Hunting Grounds Dogmen of the Lakes is available right now. And we have a link in the description of this program for you to go and get that book. We'll also talk about what we can expect when the documentary comes out. That'll come up next. Our guest is Aaron Deese. He is the author of Hunting Grounds, Dogmen of the Lakes. And when we come back, what treasures awaited Aaron when he got out there to the LBL? We'll talk about it when we come back next, right here on the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Our guest is Aaron Deese. He is the author of Hunting Grounds, Dogmen of the Lakes, talking about the LBL, the Land Between the Lakes, there in the Tennessee Valley area. Also Kentucky part of that area, correct?
Right on the border. Yeah, there are parts of the park that are in Tennessee. There are parts that are in Kentucky. When I was there, most of my visit was in Kentucky, but yeah.
Okay. All right. Before the break, we were talking about the different treasures and resources that are out in that area. One of those treasures is an actual human who's had way too many experiences, I think, in order to be comfortable. That is a man named Martin Groves. Can you tell us a little bit about Martin and what he's experienced out there?
Very happily. Martin Groves is a resident of the area. I cannot recall the town that he grew up in right now, but he has lived in the area surrounding the Land Between the Lakes for most of his life. He is a law enforcement officer who served for 30 years in that area, dealt with the absolute worst of humanity, dealt with a little bit of everything. You know, to hear him talk about his career for even a few minutes will give you chills because he's, you know, out there in the wilds, basically the Wild West, but not quite the West. You know, his background and his reputation as a law enforcement officer, as someone who's known to being very upstanding character, being very honest, those things are not subject to debate. Mm-hmm. They've been checked and cross-referenced over and over and over again. The sheriff's department he used to work for, you know, I've been told by Joe Doyle they're sick of people calling them by now to confirm Martin's identity. So there's no doubt that he is who he says he is. He is a former law enforcement officer who served in this area for a very long time. I am a big believer in examining a witness's motivations when they come forward with a story. Not because I want to disprove or catch anybody in a lie, but I believe 99% of the time people have something to lose when they make claims about running into the inexplicable, having a paranormal phenomena. And I think if you can mention something like this person had a very long career in law enforcement and has a reputation on the line, that's important because Martin had an encounter with one of these things, these dog men, in 1990, early 1990s. Whenever I get in these, the dates fall out of my head, so sure. I'm sorry, but no, it's in the book.
Yeah,
exactly. I wrote it down. It's what he said. Exactly. Early 90s, it may have been 1990, and did not tell anyone for decades. But what he did instead, this was when he was still active in law enforcement, he started documenting these reports because he was getting reports from people about seeing these creatures. And he's documented dozens of them. He's got two books out now, you know, that are just invaluable points of research for people interested in this stuff. And then finally, Heather Mosher was able to make contact with him for American Werewolves 1, the small town monster film, which I believe came out in 2020, 2021. I don't have it here in front of me right now. But that was the first time his story was shared publicly. And then all of a sudden, all these pieces start fitting into place for people looking at this stuff. Like, we've heard about this story of the LBL massacre. We've heard conjecture that, you know, if there's not a cover up, that law enforcement doesn't want people to know about it. And then here comes this gentleman who's willing to say, yeah, there is a reticence on the part of the authorities to discuss these instances. Yes, they are aware that they exist. And I can tell you that, you know, dozens of people have lost their lives in the park, in the land between the lakes, possibly at the hands of these creatures, and that those records are either very, very difficult to find or that they don't exist. While that might be a lot for some people to accept or believe, Martin is not someone with a motivation to make something like this up. He does not need to sell a few hundred, and I'm just throwing numbers out there. He does not need to sell a few hundred books about Dogman. Yeah. He's retired. He served his community, served his country. You know, he doesn't need to do that. Right. In my mind, he's doing a service to all of us by being willing to come forward and say, I had this experience, you know, and put his name and his face to it. I don't take any story from an anonymous source on the internet as fact. I'll mention it as there's conjecture over this. This has been talked about, but that's not something I can say as a verifiable testimony because I don't know who this person is. You know who Martin Groves is, and he is putting his reputation on the line by sharing this information with the world. And I can't find a whole lot more to assign a witness credibility with other than that. Sorry, I get a little fired up.
That's okay. Alitha's experience for the book, Aaron, because it is absolutely chilling. And I'll give our listeners this, that when you read it and you realize that this is a man of the law, this is a man who's been up against it, and you realize what it is that he had to face and that he felt fear. That says something. I mean, yeah, you know, I give him all the kudos and credence in the world for having faced down not just one of these things. There was a pack of them.
At least two, it seems. Yeah. Martin is very, one thing I love about speaking with him and even just reviewing his testimony, is that he speaks very factually. He will tell you what he saw. He's not going to tell you this is what it was. He'll tell you what he experienced and what he felt. He's not going to tell you, this is what happened to me. And I run into a lot of, you know, nobody in particular, but just when you're looking at a lot of eyewitness testimonies on any paranormal topic, people start arriving at conclusions and saying, this is what that was, and this proves this. And I'm not here to tell any of those people that they're wrong, but to talk to someone who has that law enforcement background, who presents this information to you almost as if it's a case report, mm-hmm. you know, an official case report, that is incredibly refreshing.
Yeah.
And to me, that just makes him more credible. But again, then I'm in the realm of my own opinion. So
no,
whatever,
absolutely.
Whatever. I will die on the Martin Groves' credible hill, though. I'll say that to anybody.
Yeah. And man, if you're talking about credibility, that's gotta be the hill to die on. I mean, I take law enforcement and people who've been trained in law enforcement a little bit of a higher hill than most, or a little bit higher credibility than most. I mean, you're trained to not only be truthful, but to see a little bit more than the average person. I mean, I think, you know, not only are you trained to retain more information in a stressful situation, but you also, let's just say, you're trained to react differently in stressful situations as well. So,
yeah,
and keep a calmer head. And so,
and you'll see that when you review his testimony. Yeah. You see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's either telling the truth about what he experienced, which is, I don't very often express opinions about these cases, but I believe Martin Groves is telling the truth. I just think that's important.
Right.
Or he is the most creative writer and the best actor I have ever met in my entire life. And he waited until the year 2020, year of our Lord, after serving in law enforcement for 30 years to attempt to utilize either of those skills.
Yeah.
He is also a very good writer. His books are great. But
okay.
I'm just saying, he either experienced this or he invented it. And I don't believe he invented it. So
now, Dogman's not the only experience he's had, correct? I mean, didn't he have an experience with Sasquatch as well?
One of the experiences I know he's had with it is that there's another gentleman who I was able to interview for the book, Mr. Daryl Denton, who is also involved in active research in the area to this day with Mr. Groves. We went out there with both of them to the location of their sighting because Mr. Groves has had more than one run-in with these things. Mr. Denton and Mr. Groves first became acquainted years ago while Martin was serving in law enforcement because Daryl was experiencing essentially what we would equate to Sasquatch activity on his property.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting the ways in which these things connect us, you know, and they were both locals of the area. Mr. Denton is a former alderman. He served as a mayor. Once again, someone with a lot of credibility and something to lose by coming forward.
Right.
A lot of times we'll ask like, well, what is this person trying to gain by sharing this story? I think that's less important than looking at what they have to lose.
Yes.
And both of these gentlemen are gambling. No, I don't want to say gambling, but both of these gentlemen took a risk by coming forward. So
I think gamble is a good word. I think gamble is an excellent word. Especially, yeah. You know, the smaller the town, the more there is to gamble. I think that's a very good word.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. And we're talking about this stuff now across state lines and people are going to listen to it, you know, all over the place. But
yeah.
This is an area where people know each other, where these gentlemen grew up and have lived most of their lives. So it's not just, oh, yeah, there's the guy down the street talking about werewolves. It's no, that's Martin Groves. I know his relatives and his friends. And I went to school with so and so. Like these folks know each other. It's a very intimate environment.
Because
is the impression I got when I was there.
Eventually, especially with electable positions, you know, there's a little bit of laughing, snickering when the election comes up and it's time for you to come up for re-election. You know, there's reputations and do you elect that person back to their position? You know, it's there. You're right. The reputation is everything. You know,
yeah.
and
it's a risk.
Yeah.
It's a risk. It's not a risk for me to say I think werewolves are real. I think
right.
people expect that of me at this point.
Right.
I'm
right.
risking nothing. The
right.
worst that
exactly.
happens to me is somebody doesn't buy my book.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
for a lot of these folks, a lot of these witnesses, that is not the case.
Right.
And I said something about that. I forget the exact wording in the acknowledgments of this book is that we're only doing this work because of these witnesses.
Yes.
So,
yeah. Correct. Another resource you had when you were out there. In the middle of the LBL was, and you mentioned them earlier in the program, was Hellbent Holler.
Yeah.
The team of Jesse and Joe Doyle. Now, their story is interesting because, if I remember right, they didn't necessarily believe when they went out to the LBL, correct?
Yes. And that's one of the reasons I consider them to be so credible is that they have always approached this phenomena from a standpoint of what I like to call optimistic skepticism,
mm-hmm.
Healthy skepticism, if you want to look at it that way, open to the data, open to the information, not going in with any preconceived notions and saying, well, this is obviously this and we're going to go prove it, but also kind of being of the mindset that this is probably not a real thing. When they started their Dogman research, they called that research period Werewolf Summer. And usually they take the summer off from field investigation because it's so dang hot out there. But they decided to postpone their annual break under, oh, sorry, Dogman Summer, not Werewolf Summer.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. That's
yep.
the name of a band or something. so they set off on Dogman Summer, ended up in the land between the lakes, and one of their first investigations had this striking encounter. And now you cannot have a conversation about Dogman in a public forum without their names coming up. And they will to this day tell you, we didn't really set out to be Dogman people, you know, and they still are researching things across the spectrum. You know, they look into a little bit of everything. And Jesse and Joe both come from backgrounds in the strange and the paranormal, but they've had historically interests in different stuff. And the way they merge all of that is so refreshing and so awesome. But yeah, they came into this stuff not thinking they were going to capture Dogman evidence, not chasing that thing necessarily. And then all of a sudden, here we are. So it kind of, to me, it kind of speaks to the way in which this phenomena, if you're looking into it even a little bit, it's very difficult not to be kind of drawn in. And it just seems to do that. I don't know why that is, but.
what I found fun, and again, you were talking about the FLIR camera. So they buy the FLIR camera, and it was one of those situations where they ordered it, and yeah, they wanted it in time for the trip, but it just so happened to get there in time. But if it didn't get there in time, that was okay. They weren't too serious about the trip anyways. It was just a little excavation to see if they could see what they were going to see. But luckily, it got there in time, and they got the evidence they got.
Yeah, a lot of pieces slotted into place for them very nicely. And you can see the whole saga of their trip into the Land Between the Lakes on the YouTube videos they put out, the werewolf experiments, a couple years ago. But it was so... I was so excited to be able to include all the details of that story in the book. And they reviewed it before publication to make sure everything is factually correct. So that's good.
Yeah.
But because I'm like, this is a very important progression of events from these people who have the qualifications to look into this stuff, have the mindset to do it skeptically, but still be open to the information. And then had all these little experiences that sort of fell into place at the same time. Like you said, the thermal showed up just in time. They were in the right place at the right time to capture this image and to do it, like we said earlier, in the middle of the summer, when by all rights, you shouldn't have been able to see very much in a thermal imager set to black hot. And yet here we are having this conversation. So
when you look into their eyes now, is the passion sparked there? Do you see a change in their goals for investigation? Because you did say they had other goals as far as paranormal investigation. Are they fully focused now on Dogman?
Forgot how to form a sentence again there. Sorry, Tim.
That's all right.
So they actually just put out a video a few days ago on YouTube involving Sasquatch research in Georgia, if I'm not mistaken.
Really?
So they're continuing to, research the breadth of things and kind of look at different areas. That's one thing I love about what they do is they are very open to the whole scope of things. But Jesse and Joe, as far as I'm aware, have not become full-time Dogman researchers.
But
one thing that was interesting when we talked was that they said, and they both kind of correlated this, was that after having this encounter and capturing this image that so closely visually resembles something that they had been more skeptical of, they said it kind of forced them to go back and reassess some of the other things they'd experienced in the woods, some of the other things that they had run into, going, okay, well, now this has happened. What about all this other stuff? And that's one of the things I love about them, other than the fact that they're just great people and very good friends. That's another hill I'll die on. It's one thing I love so much is that they're willing to reassess and willing to be open-minded, because a lot of people in this community will not do that.
Right.
It is this, or it is that, or I don't want to talk about it. To me, that runs counterintuitive to an interest in the paranormal, but whatever, that's a separate conversation.
Sure.
But Jesse and Joe are some of those people that anything they say, I'm going to be willing to back them up on.
Right on.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Shannon and her experience out there.
Heck yeah.
How did you find, and did she change her mind or opinion or anything about what she had experienced prior to any of the other experiences she's had as part of Small Town Monsters? We all change and grow in the way we investigate from investigation to investigation. Sometimes we form different opinions based on the investigations that we conduct. Sometimes we change our theories on things. Sometimes we have an experience in an investigation and go, you know what? That changed my mind in one way or another. Did this investigation change Shannon in the way she looks at things?
So I don't want to speak for her.
Okay.
But based on our conversations, I would say no, because Shannon is even more open-minded on this topic than I am, because I'm kind of obsessed with it. And Shannon's research and her inner, she knows a lot about everything. She's able to look at the whole scope of things. She's very good at looking at the big picture side of this phenomena. And that's been so helpful and so refreshing for me, especially writing this book, because when I wrote the Texas Dogman Triangle, Shannon and I kind of linked up on this for the documentary after the book had been written.
Okay.
This time she literally was on the road with me while I was making notes and writing stuff down. So she also wrote the foreword for the book. So her voice is very much a part of this one, which I'm so happy about. But Shannon, again, is very good about looking at the whole scope and being very open-minded. And by the end of our trip to the Land Between the Lakes together, I think both of us were kind of a mindset that there's still too much we don't know. There's too much supernatural stuff to use very unelaborate wording, supernatural stuff to say, yeah, these are cryptids, these are animals, these are biological beings definitively. But there is also too much on the side that we can point to as being the activity of known canines to say this is definitely some kind of a ghost or a spiritual being. A translucent ghost, how is it going to leave footprints? How is it going to disturb the surrounding environment? Why would it need to feed or prey on human beings or animals, which if any of these reports are to be believed, it seems that's what they do.
Yeah.
Neither explanation fits right now. So for me, that's where I'm at. I need more information. I need more time. If I had to guess, I would say that's probably where Shannon is too. But I know she's very open to the idea of it being a supernatural phenomenon. So,
okay.
Sorry if I got that wrong, Shannon.
No, you know, that's very interesting because, you know, there are, and again, I don't want to give away too much about the book because there are reports of things like people taking shots at this thing.
Yes.
But not a lot as to whether there were blood trails or actual physical evidence of, you know, following up on these things or wounded dogmen or bodies being found or, you know, bones being found of this thing. Is there reports or did you come across reports of people finding carcasses or bodies of these things or grave sites or anything like that?
We don't have any specimens. We don't have any specimens and we don't have any specimens. And that's the biggest problem with dogman research. And this is something I spent a significant amount of time talking about in the book, is that we lack the body of evidence that we even have in the Sasquatch world.
Okay.
But here's the problem. We can point to strange hair samples that may come from Sasquatch and say, look, this is some kind of primate DNA in this hair found in a place where there's not supposed to be primates. That's a real thing that's happened.
Yeah.
We know what canine DNA looks like, and canines are all over the place. There's no reason to necessarily assume that a hair sample or DNA or a blood sample from a dogman, which is a biological canine breed, if we're going with that assumption, would look any different from known canine DNA. In the early days of the Texas Chupacabra, aka the Texas Terror Dog, you know, they did genetic testing on it and they said, well, this is a mix between, you know, Mexican red wolves and coyotes and domestic dogs. That is a canine hybrid that at one time we classified as a cryptid. We still do classify as a cryptid. We still don't know exactly what it is, but it's something that we know exists and we know it's an intermixing of different canine breeds. So if we had dogman DNA, why would it look any different? And until we can put one in a cage and draw blood from it and say, okay, this is what dogman blood looks like, there's no way to assume that if we found a dogman skull in the woods, that it would look any different than that of a wolf or something like that.
What's interesting What's interesting is the one picture that we see in the book, it's hard to tell because you have the long elongated ears. But you don't really get a good look at the skull as to whether, and we have a description from different eyewitnesses that there's that canid snout. But there's not really anything like if you were to run across a skull in the woods, you wouldn't be able to tell if that were a wolf skull or if it were, you know.
Exactly. Trace evidence, amongst canine breeds is going to look on the surface pretty similar. You know, the ways in which they mark their territory, they leave and conceal waste, they leave and conceal the scraps of kills. That looks pretty similar across the board.
Yeah.
If this is a canine species of some kind, or even if they're genetic one-offs that aren't capable of breeding, which is another theory I'm very fond of, the trace evidence they would leave behind, even the physical remains, would be very, very difficult to identify. You know, if we found a primate skeleton in the woods, okay, guys, I think we found Bigfoot, or at least we found the source of some of these Bigfoot reports. Yeah. We're not going to know that with a canine.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It makes it much, much harder. Plus, man, the hair sample would be so tough. With wolves in general, I know here in Minnesota, we have Timberwolves, I'm not talking about the NBA team, but we have all different types of wolves that, especially with the DNR trying to repopulate the wolf population here in Minnesota. If we had a dogman problem here in Minnesota, you'd never know it. With them trying to repopulate the wolf population here in Minnesota, it's just. You'd never know that there was one running around here. So I can't imagine in other states what it'd be like.
Yeah, but in a place like the Land Between the Lakes, where again, there aren't a lot of eyes out there, you know? And if we do have a few specimens over the years where, hey, this wolf coyote dog mix was able to walk on two legs, but it never reproduced because some canine breeds can't reproduce due to the mixture of their genetics, some people had a sighting of it. Maybe it attacked somebody. That makes logical sense. And I'm saying this as someone who is neither a scientist, a veterinarian, a game warden, and who isn't even a hunter. I just like to hike. But that makes sense based on what we know canines do to me. So.
So as we begin to wrap stuff up, let me ask you about this. In the book, you mentioned there's the documentary being shot with it that you did this simultaneously.
Yeah.
I always look forward to these documentaries you guys shoot. So when can we look forward to it?
So I don't know how much I'm allowed to say, but I can say that the film has been completed,
Okay.
including soundtrack and visual effects and editing. I can tell you that Mr. Breedlove and the rest of the team are in the process of getting it ready to be unleashed upon the
Ah.
world. I think I'm okay to say that we hope to have it out before Monster Fest, which is June 28th and June 29th.
Nice.
Hope to. I don't know anything definitively, but I know the hope is to actually, Seth said on the internet May or June. So yeah, we're hoping to have it out.
Okay.
I was trying to think back, what has Seth said publicly that I can repeat? Yeah, we're hoping to have it out May, June. So yeah, keep your eyes peeled, definitely. It'll be streaming on Amazon. You'll be able to get physical copies from shop.smalltownmonsters.com. Yeah. But the documentary was so cool because, like I said, for Dogman Triangle, I wrote the book and then, you know, Seth and Heather and everybody came up with the idea for the documentary. We linked up with Shannon and then we did the documentary.
Okay.
This time I wrote the book as we were filming the doc. And so they intersect a lot. You're going to see things that are kind of redundant from the book to the film. But then there's stuff in the movie that didn't make it into the book just because it didn't work as well. And there's stuff in the book that is not in the movie because it's research I did on my own time, you know? So
They're
you
good.
don't need to check out both if you're a person. Like, I'm not here going, oh, they're just trying to get us to spend more money. No, we want to put this information out there in as many ways as possible to present it to as many people as possible to make it more accessible. So I recommend reading the book and watching the movie, obviously, because you're going to get a more complete picture. But, you know, this story is accessible from Small Town Monsters in a couple of locations because we really want to make it as available as we can.
It sounds like they're good companion pieces, that they really are. That
I
they
think so.
like
I
peanut
think
butter and
so.
jelly, really.
Yeah. And
Yeah.
there's like shots in the film where, you know, you'll see me taking notes in a notepad. That wasn't for effect. I'm using those notes. I have that notebook. I reference it very regularly. So it's cool because for me, this wasn't just researching the Land Between the Lakes. I also literally went on this whole journey. And that's also a part of the narrative of the book. I have some notes in there that are just notes I took in Kentucky that made it in. So it's going to be a fun experience, I think. And kind of collectively at Small Town Monsters, we've sort of pointed the lens at the Land Between the Lakes. You know, Alex Petikoff has done some work out there, and there may be some other projects coming up that involve footage we shot while we were in the LBL. So this is just one aspect of what's going on out there that we're, you know, putting out there.
There's scenes in here, my friend, where you guys are crawling around, Jesse and Joe and you and Shannon, where it seems like you're in a lot more Dutch than you probably should be, where you're crawling around in different areas and caves and in places where you could potentially be in physical harm, where I can't wait to see it on film. I know that much. And looking for not only looking for these creatures, but looking for different clues as well. And yeah, no, go ahead, go ahead.
Sorry. No, I was just going to say, you hear all this conjecture, you know, and you hear people say like, oh, there are underground tunnels and underground bunkers in the Land Between the Lakes. You know, that sounds dumb. That doesn't sound real. Okay. That sounds like something, oh, someone saw a shed and they assumed it was a bunker. But then you actually go to the Land Between the Lakes and you go in this 5 by 5, maybe 10, not 10 by 10, maybe 6 by 7 concrete room in the middle of the woods, and you stomp on the floor and you hear this loud booming noise. I played drums for years, and I still have a collection of djembe and bongos and things like that. It sounded like a giant drum.
Really?
So there is hollow space under these concrete structures in the middle of the Land Between the Lakes, and we don't know what they are. could be cisterns of some kind, could just be like a septic tank that was abandoned. I don't know what it is, but the fact is that exists there. And I know that because I stood on top of it and I pounded on it. So
could we just be thinking maybe it's for more devious purposes? I mean, like,
well, and that's the conjecture. The conjecture is that these are underground tunnels that the government would use, or that the TVA would use to hide out, or, you know, pursue the dogman. If they were hunting them during the day, maybe they hid out in these tunnels at night. That kind of doesn't work for me, because if you have time to build these tunnels in an area where you need them to hide out, why haven't you been attacked while you're building? You know what I mean? That doesn't quite work for me. But the fact is that we do have all these structures of indeterminate purpose in an area where there is massive conjecture and rumor, and in some cases, confirmation of the government either covering things up or just not being eager to discuss what's going on there. So I don't know, man. We don't know exactly what some of these structures are. We know they weren't there pre-Land Between the Lakes, pre-TVA era. We know they're not from the families of the settlers. So what are they?
Yeah.
So these structures, just to describe, I mean, we'll see them in the movie, but just to describe them, are they, they're not shoddily built like they were built by families, but they look like they're more professionally built? Like,
yeah, these are very sturdy, and there's plenty of, you know, in an area like this, there are a lot of campgrounds that were kind of developed and then abandoned over the years. So some of it, you'll have a concrete slab in the middle of the woods. It looks kind of strange, but when you walk up to it and look at it, it was clearly like a shower, you know, bank at one time. You can see where the pipes and drains are. But the ones I'm referring to specifically are these squat, sturdy cinder block structures. Again, somewhere between 5'5 and 10'10, you know, the ones that we checked out, they didn't have doors. There's no windows in there. They look like bunkers. Now, if you were setting up a storage shed or a storage facility that was going to be out there in the elements for years and years and years, that's what you would build it out of. You're not going to build it out of wood or something like that, because you need it to last. So yeah, it tracks that you could go, okay, they built these as storage facilities or something. But why is there hollow space underneath them? Why? And Jesse and Joe have run into other areas where there seem to be underground passages or tunnels. Not seem to be. There are.
Yeah.
Leading off into the indeterminate distance, or just in places where there doesn't seem to be a reason for it. So, you know, we can point to at least two examples of documented on camera structures in the woods of indeterminate purpose with hollow spaces underneath them. Does that mean that the government has a secret network of tunnels under the Land Between the Lakes? No, I can't prove that. But I can prove to you that something that people can take and assume that exists in that area.
It's almost like they started to build an underground base and they gave up on it.
Yeah, and that's kind of what it seems like. And again, I don't want to say that that's what I believe, but you can't deny that that's a very strange thing, especially when you find it in this place, you know, where we know the government was very active, and where we know we have all these stories about. It's so hard not to leap to conclusions sometimes, but yeah, the Land Between the Lakes, yeah, it makes it to where you almost don't have to, because you have all these bits of information and you can look at it and go, wow, like, regardless of the conclusion I arrive at, this is a really weird place.
Well, isn't there one story about a government breeding program leading to Dog Man?
Yes. One of the witnesses who I spoke to, that is their opinion. They stated that they believe that to be fact and have had some of their own experiences that they claim corroborate that viewpoint. Outside of talking to that person, I have not run across any other testimonies that lead me in that direction. I'll be honest, I don't think that's what's going on here.
Okay.
Is it possible? Yeah, absolutely. The government does all kinds of crazy stuff that we don't know about.
Yeah.
So sure, maybe, but I have not seen evidence to point me in that direction and to draw me to that conclusion. If we find some kind of a declassified document via FOIA request or the National Archives or something one day that points in that direction, I'm all here for it. But the lines along which my research has fallen have not taken me in that direction. I would be more inclined to believe that these are something beyond the veil of what we understand as reality based on what I've researched. So, but again, I'm not here to tell anybody they're wrong. That's sure. Just what it looks like to me.
Wouldn't that be something of what you ran across with some sort of abandoned holding pens?
That's one of the theories that Jesse and Joe discuss with us, and you'll see this in the book as well, is that maybe these are facilities that were to contain these creatures. We capture them and lock them up. And some of the conjecture there is that, yeah, the government would keep them in these bunkers and send groups of soldiers into the woods and then release them so they can hunt them. Or the dogmen themselves were meant to be super soldiers that they were testing, and they were sending U.S. military in there as cannon fodder. You know, that's just kind of what you see when you start looking at discussion groups online. And I, as part of the research phase for this book, I followed every dogman group I could find on Facebook, and proceed at your own caveat emptor if you choose to do that. But that is a recurring comment that I see, is that people believe these things are government experiments that are either meant to be super soldiers in development or are meant to be training exercises for our existing special forces, which both of those, there's a lot of problems logically, but what do I know? MK Ultra was a real thing. So,
yeah, well, that's exactly it. I mean, how many years did people talk about MK Ultra? Then all of a sudden there's nuggets of real stuff that pops up. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, a year from now, there may be a whole wave of stuff that comes out and someone listens back on this interview and goes, wow, this Aaron guy's a complete moron. That's fine. More information, the better. But I don't see that as being a good explanation for this on the whole.
Right.
It doesn't. In my mind, it's not going that way. But again, that's just me. There are people who have experienced things that I may never learn about. So I don't know.
There's nothing wrong with talking speculation, Aaron. I mean, they do it all day long on NFL Network. But, you know,
the stock market, the meteorology. Speculation's
that's right. Speculation's always fun to talk about. But, you know, whether it's true or not, that's a whole different ball game. That's for sure. Folks, I encourage you to go out and get this book. It is fantastic, and I can't wait for the movie to come out as well, Aaron. I'm telling you, Hunting Grounds is Hunting Grounds Dogmen. Just a second here, I lost my email.
It's a long title.
It's not. Hunting Grounds Dogmen of the Lakes is the name of the book. And we can't wait for the movies from Small Town Monsters. We've also got links to the website as well. Get the book. Can't wait for the movie. Aaron Deese, I want to thank you so much for being with us today, my friend.
Thank you, man. I always enjoy talking with you. Thank you so much.
Enjoy talking to you as well. I want to thank Aaron Deese for being on the program today. Hunting Grounds, Dogmen of the Lakes is available right now by Small Town Monsters. We got a link in the description of this program so you can go get it. Can't wait for the documentary to come out. Again, it's Aaron, it's Shannon LeGros. Martin Groves makes an appearance along with, again, a lot of the cast that you heard about here in this podcast. Man, I tell you, when you see that FLIR footage of that creature, it's going to freak you out. Even the picture in the book freaks you out. Just those pointy ears against that black image on that FLIR camera, folks. Get the book. You have to read some of the adventures that Aaron was on there in the LBL. I saved a lot of it for you to read, because some of the adventures that Martin's been on, some of the stuff that they go through in the LBL, you got to read it for yourself, folks. Dogmen is just one of those things that just absolutely terrifies me. And I know it'll terrify you too. Having spent a lot of time in the woods myself, I like my little bubble of security. And I'd like to think that there's that bubble of security still there for me. Although after reading this book, I'm just so glad nobody's told me that there's dogmen in the woods in Minnesota. I'll choose to think the dogman is not in Minnesota. Thank you very much. I'll just stick with my belief that timberwolves are in northern Minnesota, and I choose not to go in the woods there. So there you go. Folks, we're coming up on the weekend, and I put out my attitude of gratitude, and I want to thank you all for continuing to listen to this program. I want to thank you first and foremost for continuing to patronize our sponsors. Please go out there and give them all a try. Surfshark VPN. Give them a try. Go out and try them all. They're listed on our website, darknessradioshow.com. Just go to the bottom of the page. Pick one and give it a try this weekend, if you would. A little bit of homework for you. If you would, please visit and patronize our sponsors. We appreciate it. It keeps us going here on the show. And if you like our show, if you like some of the shows you've heard, please rate and review us. Give us a 5-star review. We'd appreciate that as well. It gets people to notice us out there in the internet scape, if you will, and gets us out there. That's what we would like. Keeps Timmy in a job, and it keeps Jess and it keeps Mally in a job as well. Speaking of keeping people in a job, people keep asking me what's going on with Beer City Bruiser. Well, he is again keeping the house in repairs. Things are going slow with the house repairs, and things are going slow with things there in North Carolina. So he is going through stuff there in North Carolina. He's hoping to return to the show sooner than later. Drop him a line if you'd like to see him on his social media, at his Facebook page, if you'd like to see him back here on the show. That's all I'll say. So there you go. The other thing I ask of you this weekend is do something kind for a neighbor, a friend, or whatnot. Be a light in someone's darkness. I know I say that every weekend, but please do something kind for somebody this weekend. Another quick note for you. I just got back from a concert. Went to a concert tonight with my nephew. It took him for his birthday to go see Steve Vai and Joe Satriani. They're on a joint tour together. It's kind of an interesting experience. I'll just recap it for you briefly. And here's why it's an interesting experience. So I've been a fan of Steve Vai and Joe Satriani since I was in high school. And my nephew is now 20 years old. I played guitar forever. He's played guitar since he was young. So it's kind of generations coming together, going and watching a generational talent or generational talents, right? So after the concert, we didn't have meet and greets or anything like that. We're going back to the car. And the buses are right near our parking garage where we parked. So I said to my nephew, I said, do you want to wait and see if Vai or Satriani come out to the buses? Now, normally they get off stage and boom, they're right to the buses and off they go. So I said, sure, we can wait for a little bit. Well, we waited for a little over an hour. And the security guard goes, nope, they're already on the buses. They're all getting ready to go. Well, we had seen different band members get on the buses, you know, of the supporting band. But we hadn't seen either Vai or Satriani get on the bus. So when the security guard said, nah, buses are taking off in 5 minutes, they're packing up, they're getting ready to go. We gave it about 3 minutes. And I said to my nephew, I said, well, what do you think, kid? Should we head off? And he said, yeah, I guess so, because it was already after 11 o'clock and, you know, the building where we parked was officially closed. I didn't know how we were going to get back to our van, right, to get out of downtown Minneapolis. I figured we were screwed. So as we're starting to head for the corner, we had to take a right and then head up a couple blocks to get to the parking garage. We get to the corner. I take a right to get to the intersection, and I see him turn to his left and go, hey, how you doing? Sure enough, there's Steve Vai. He's the lucky one of the family. And I go, who is that? And he goes, Steve Vai. And I go, you're kidding me. And he goes, no. And I go, you want to turn back and say hey? And he goes, fuck yeah. I'm not going to curb my language here. So we turn back and we race after him. I'm on my scooter, of course. I can't walk that far yet. And we go back. And of course, he's stopped by a couple other people. There weren't too many people left waiting after an hour, but there was enough just to slow him up. And I ask him for a couple of pictures with my nephew. And I had to make a decision because he's moved on after I take a couple pictures with the nephew. And I figure the fanboy in me says, do I ask for a photo with him? Does 16-year-old Timmy want a photo with him? or does the 50-year-old Timmy want to book him for the show? The 50-year-old Timmy want out. So I asked Steve, do you ever talk about the paranormal? He said, never the paranormal, but I do talk spirituality. Steve's very spiritual. Now, if you're a fan of Steve Vai, he does talk about, you know, he's talked about aliens, pyramids, God. His best song, his most famous song, is For the Love of God. And I've always wanted to talk about that song to him. That song just hits me right in the heartstrings. So I got his agent's contact information, and I want to book him for the show. That, to me, is one of the great white whales. That's the person I want to have on the show. So hopefully, when I ask for guest suggestions, that's one of the big guest suggestions. I think that's about it. Yeah. We're coming up on the end of April. I do want to... It's a little late in coming. We're getting to... As we get to the end of April, my sister Stephanie's birthday was on the 23rd, so I want to say happy birthday to Stephanie. And intern Yoko's birthday is coming up on the 28th. So before we hit the 28th, I want to say happy birthday to intern Yoko, both two ladies who are the lights of my life. So I want to extend those birthday wishes out there. Also, a reminder, go to darknessradioshow.com. Go to the events page. Get your tickets, as little as they remain, for the Palmer House event, the Potographs for Pooches event at the Palmer House, late May, and for Michigan Paracon coming up in August. Brad Blair will be on the program on Tuesday for True Crime Tuesday. We'll be talking paranormal justice, his brand new book. Of course, Brad Blair, one of the organizers of Michigan Paracon. So looking forward to that. Got a little surprise for you on Thursday. So there you go. Good stuff coming up for end of April, beginning of May. Looking forward to these shows here. And I hope you're enjoying the shows that we've been putting out there for you. And again, if you have a guest you want to hear, send me the guest referral to tim@darknessradio.com. That'll be it for this week. Thank you so much once again for listening to the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio.